Governor Walker, along with three other Republican presidential candidates, has said that he supports the First Amendment Defense Act. Supporters of this legislation say it would protect people's religious beliefs about marriage. Opponents say it would result in discrimination against gays and people who have sex outside of marriage. Here's Governor Walker responding to a question from the Christian Broadcasting Network about whether he'd support that bill.
Absolutely. I mean, to me, protecting our constitutional rights shouldn't just take a piece of legislation. That's something the president and elected members of the House and Senate, by the oath we take. I take an oath as a governor to support the Constitution, not only of my state, but of the United States. I think that's implicit. The oath that any federal officer takes is about upholding the Constitution, and the Constitution is very clear about protecting those rights.
Congress members from Wisconsin who have signed on as co-sponsors of the First Amendment Defense Act include Representatives Glenn Grothman and Reed Ribble and Senator Ron Johnson.
Here with us now to talk about what the bill would do is Howard Schwaber. He is a political science professor at UW-Madison, focusing on constitutional law and legal theory. Howard, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi there.
Well, can you sum up first? How do you read this bill? What does it say and do?
Sure. So this is a new version of what are sometimes called religious freedom restoration acts. There's a long history of these. Historically, it used to be the case that under Supreme Court precedent, the First Amendment was understood to mean that a general law couldn't be applied against a person who had religious objections unless the government could meet a very high standard of proof. That changed in 1990 when the Supreme Court, an opinion by Justice Scalia, declared that there's no need to make religious accommodations. States are permitted to make such accommodations if they want to, but they don't have to. That led to Congress enacting the first Religious Freedom Restoration Act in 1983, which said, no, the Supreme Court is wrong. Under the First Amendment, it should be the case that a generally applicable law, think a speed limit, right? A law that applies to everyone has to make exceptions for people for whom the law violates their religious beliefs. Or unless the government can meet this very, very high standard of justification. The Supreme Court turned around and said that that law was unconstitutional. Here's Congress trying again. So what this law does is this law applies only to the federal government, which the Supreme Court says Congress can do. And it says, in general terms, that federal law should not be applied in any way that would infringe on anyone's religious or moral beliefs on the question that, quote, marriage is or should be recognized as the union of one man and one woman, or that sexual relations are properly reserved to such a marriage.
And let's put this in the political context. Obviously, this is coming out after a Supreme Court ruling which legalized same-sex marriage in the states that hadn't done that yet, either by legislative initiative or by the courts. So this is part of the response trying to figure out what the landscape is in the aftermath of that ruling.
Well, that's right. And to be just a little more specific, it's also building on Hobby Lobby, the case that said that the federal government cannot require corporations to provide contraceptive coverage against the religious beliefs of their owners. So the way the law is written, it's extraordinarily broad, just incredibly broad. Person includes for-profit businesses, corporations, entities of any kind. Discriminatory action, the things the federal government is forbidden to do, include revoking tax-exempt status or enforcing anti-discrimination law or conditioning grants or loans or benefits or employment. And there's no need for religious belief. It's religious belief or a moral conviction. And the government is prohibited from interfering with acts as well as beliefs. And so what you end up with is a very, very, just an amazingly sweeping rule that first says no federal law can be applied in any way to say that parties ought not may not discriminate against gays or lesbians. But more than that, whether, by the way, they are married or not, but more than that, this would authorize or prevent the federal government from preventing discrimination against people who have sex outside of marriage, the most obvious category of others.
And this was presented by supporters in Congress and supporters, as we heard from Governor Walker, as fairly innocuous. We have religious liberty in the United States. We shouldn't be punished for expressing or practicing a moral view. you say this is fairly broad, though. So you see this as not innocuous legislation.
It's not innocuous at all. It's extremely radical. I heard Governor Walker's statement to the Christian Broadcasting Service. He was exhibiting a fairly simplistic notion of what it means to have this constitutional right. So there is certainly a constitutional right to free exercise of religion. And historically, that's always been understood to mean that, you know, the government has to meet a high level of justification before it can infringe on religious beliefs or actions, and especially that no one can tell anyone what to believe or how to worship or whether to attend a church or anything of that sort. But no one has ever said before, for example, that if I say I have a moral objection to taxes, therefore I don't have to pay taxes and can't be punished for not paying taxes. Or I have a religious belief in, you know, committing what would otherwise be murder, I have to be allowed to commit murder. That's never been true. And again, since 1990, the Supreme Court has said, in fact, there's no such constitutional requirement at all to make allowances. So in the first place, this is very clearly a specific measure targeted at same-sex marriage, targeted at permitting individuals, businesses, entities, government offices to discriminate against gays and lesbians, LGBT persons. In the second place, it's just written, as I mentioned before, unprecedentedly broadly. You know, if you go back far enough, there used to be laws in this country that states could enforce against what was called fornication, meaning sex outside of authorized marriage. And of course, the usual way someone gets caught that way is a woman who is not married becomes pregnant. But it can also be used if someone files a statement saying, you know, I believe so-and-so is engaged in this kind of sexual behavior. And at this point, the way the law is written, if it were to become law, which is wildly unlikely. This is a political stunt, not a piece of legislation. But if this ever were to actually become the law of the land, it would mean the federal government could not prevent discrimination on the basis of a vast range of characteristics having to do with anyone's belief about someone else's sexual behavior, sexual orientation, the state of their marriage, whether they're divorced, whether they have a child after a divorce. You know, anyone whose moral preferences are offended by another person's behavior with respect to sex and reproduction, basically has free rein to engage in discrimination in any way they see fit as far as the federal government is concerned.
Talking to Howard Schwaber from the UW-Madison about the First Amendment Defense Act in Congress now. It's been in the presidential race with some Republican candidates, including Governor Walker, saying that they would support this kind of legislation. And Howard, one of the examples that people are concerned about in explaining the need for this kind of law at a state or federal level is, okay, if a church declines to perform same-sex ceremonies or hire people in positions at the church because that clashes with their religious beliefs, is it possible that they could lose their nonprofit status, that they could be required to pay taxes, which they currently don't have to do as a church? Is that a realistic concern?
No, that's preposterous. No one has ever required, as was pointed out in the Supreme Court argument, no one has ever required a Christian church to perform a Jewish marriage, for example. Nor are Orthodox Jewish synagogues required to perform Reformed Jewish services or marriages or anything else of that sort. That's an obvious and that's a trivially obvious case of free exercise. It's a complete bugaboo. There's no theory under which a religious clergyman or a church could be compelled to perform a marriage or recognize a marriage or act in or accept into their community somebody they don't want. That's a complete red herring. It's as false an issue as it gets. This would be more the case that, for example, a landlord could refuse to rent apartments to non-married cohabiting adults or to evict a woman who is a tenant who has a male guest overnight, and if somehow the landlord has reason to believe they're engaged in sexual activities outside of marriage. Or a university could fire a woman faculty member who becomes pregnant if she is not married. Or hospitals could refuse to provide services for sexually transmitted diseases or sexual conditions for non-married persons. And of course, any of these entities would be free. Again, as far as federal law is concerned, states have their own laws, but as far as federal law is concerned, would be free to engage in any kind of discriminatory treatment on the basis of sexuality or sexual conduct without any fear of federal consequences. But I really can't emphasize this strongly enough. It's complete fantasy that there's ever been a theory that said a member of a religious order, a clergyman or a church, could be required to perform a religious sacrament or religious event outside of their faith.
Now, critics of this law have said the way it's worded, potentially a federal employee, say somebody issuing Social Security checks, it might be able to choose not to issue such a check to a same-sex married couple and That's okay. It would be like a conscience clause that some states have for pharmacists. Do you read the bill as allowing that?
Well, it could. So, first of all, it says not only religious belief, but also moral conviction. So there isn't actually any need to invoke religion here. A person can just say, well, I don't think these people ought to be receiving federal benefits. And then what the law says is the government may not take any discriminatory action against such a person for acting on that belief, and that kind of discriminatory action includes employment or benefits. So, yeah, I mean, read literally, it says a federal employee who refuses to serve certain categories of people because of a moral conviction that they shouldn't live in the way that they're living, if it has to do with sex and marriage, cannot be fired for refusing to do their job. It does. Read literally, it would provide that kind of a cover.
We're talking to Howard Schwaber, political science professor at UW-Madison, about the First Amendment Defense Act. Sponsors include two congressional representatives, one senator from Wisconsin, and Governor Walker has said in his presidential campaign he supports it.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think about that bill? According to the bill's authors, it's designed to, quote, prevent discriminatory treatment of any person on the basis of views held with respect to marriage. Legal commentators say it could allow employers to fire gay people and unmarried parents, as well as maybe not rent to them and allow government employees not to file Social Security for them or for their children. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation with Howard Schwaber, political science professor at UW-Madison, about the First Amendment Defense Act, which Governor Walker has said he supports.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this idea, this kind of legislation, in effect a new version of Religious Freedom Restoration Acts that they've been called in the past? According to the bill's authors, it's intended to prevent discriminatory treatment based on what people think a marriage is. Some critics say it could open the door to a lot more discrimination without any federal ability to change that, to fix it. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. To our callers now, we've got Nick on the line in New Richmond. Nick, hi.
Hi. My comment is, where did the term marriage come from? And from where I'm sitting, it comes from God, between a man and a woman. So what I think would have been a better way to go about this is to abolish marriage as an institution endorsed by the government, because it is a religious ceremony, rite, sacrament, or whatever you want to call it, and turn it into a civil union so people could still get married, whether they're Catholic, Christian, Jewish, Muslim, or whatever, and inside that religion, be married inside that faith. But to be recognized by the government as two people being in bond with each other, being responsible for their transactions in life.
I gotcha, Nick. Thanks for the call. And Howard, this is an argument I'd heard sometimes from people on both sides of this issue. Maybe the answer, people said, is to separate out marriage as a religious institution and this contractual union that the government recognizes. That ship may have sailed already, though.
Well, I mean, that ship sailed sometime around 800 or 900 years ago, actually. Marriage is, I mean, Nick asked, where did marriage come from? Actually, I mean, the term is not a religious term. It's a legal term. In the 17th century, for example, in New England, in Puritan Massachusetts, churches were not allowed to perform marriages because no one wanted any misunderstanding that this was a religious action. To this day, if a member of the clergy in Wisconsin performs a wedding, at the end of the ceremony, he or she says, by the authority vested in me by the state of Wisconsin, I now pronounce you man and wife. And the point is that it's the state government that's delegated this authority. And the reason is that marriage is the name of a civil relationship with legal obligations. Now, Nick is making an interesting suggestion. He's saying, you know, we could split the word. We could shift the meaning of the word marriage to mean solely religious recognition of that status, and use a different phrase, such as civil union, to mean the legal status and all the benefits that go with it. And in a sense, one could. The problem would be if some people are allowed to call their relationships marriages and others are not, and if there are legal consequences to that difference, you know, then you have an equality problem, and that's what the Supreme Court was focusing on. And they also focused on the point that the word marriage carries a certain dignity, a certain value to it, and say that some people are allowed to use it and others are not, you know, is perhaps also necessarily unequal. But in one sense, Nick's quite right. That is, that the thing that we care about is what the government recognizes and how the government treats people. And the role of churches and religious entities in this is only really secondhand and allowed by the government as sufferance, as kind of a favor, a special prerogative to religious people. And it would be perfectly possible to end that. You could change it a different way. You could say churches may only perform covenant ceremonies, and the word marriage will only refer to the legal or civil relationship. And that would solve that problem as well.
Nick, thanks for the call. We'll go to Mark in Oconomowoc now. Mark, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I just had an interesting point. I mean, we know that we currently have law on the books today that says that you cannot discriminate based upon religious preference. So if an individual says that they will not make a wedding cake for a same-sex couple based upon their strongly held religious beliefs, why cannot the same-sex couple claim the same thing, meaning it's their deeply held religious beliefs that their marriage is a sacred and condoned vow? So I don't understand why we couldn't go after that situation based upon a denial of religious beliefs, meaning your religion cannot trump mine.
Mark, thanks for the call. So the defending liberty argument, he says, falls both ways in a situation like that, Howard.
Well, in a sense, it does. This is really—that's a really complicated hypothetical. Mm-hmm. So let's take the case of the baker who declines to make a cake for in celebration of a same-sex wedding. In the first place, those cases have arisen under state laws, which matters only because 50 states have 50 different sets of laws, and the particular law we're talking about isn't really about that. Some state laws say say it's unlawful if you're a business open to the public to refuse to do business with people based on their sexual orientation. And the response would be, yes, but this is our religiously held belief, and that's what the caller is talking about. Now, ordinarily, a religiously held belief can be a reason, or can be argued to be a reason, that you shouldn't have to comply with a certain otherwise applicable general law. It's not usually a reason that you can compel a third party to provide you with a service. So, you know, I have a deeply held religious belief that I ought to have my lawn mowed without paying for it does not get a landscaping company to come out and mow my lawn. Or even that I should be allowed to have my lawn mowed and pay for it. The only thing that would compel that company to come and provide me with that service is if there were a law saying the company, if they hold themselves open to the public at large, has to serve everyone equally. So it's a clever argument, but mechanically it doesn't quite work out. But he's quite right that, you know, what we're talking about, and particularly in the state law cases, is a clash between two different kinds of claims of liberty. And one is a liberty of equal treatment, and one is a liberty to run your life in accordance with your own religious beliefs. And the question is, when you are the government, or when you open a business open to the public, or when you perform a public service, or when you occupy one of these various legally special statuses, do you have special obligations, special responsibilities? We allow you to form a corporation. Does that mean we can ask you to accept certain duties, like serving everyone equally? And that's the clash that's going on right now. No one has ever proposed, for example, that a person is required to allow same-sex couples in their living room. No one has ever proposed that you have to make friends with a homosexual person or you might be violating the law. It's only when people go into business or operate a service on behalf of the government that this question of a right to equal treatment becomes balanced against this question of a right to live my life in the way I want. And historically, the answer has been, at least since 1990, especially as a constitutional matter, your right to live your life the way you want ends when you infringe on generally applicable laws that protect everybody equally.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to Howard Schwaber, political science professor at UW-Madison, talking about the First Amendment Defense Act before Congress.